bottom line. And so, the main objective, if you haven't seen that before, there are some metadata that I should comment on for you, since basically the type of data that I actually, more than one previous Perimeter Institute seminar, I described the data that I was waiting for, and now this data is here, and of course, I'd like to comment on them, and they're very interesting, and you will see what I mean with the lazy photon and mystery noise later on. And that's my key objective, since I have to play the role of a bunch of other terminologists. But I'll try to say it very quickly, because I do want to get to the final part. I'm not sure I've managed, but because also for one of the objectives that I have been promising to look for in these visits to Perimeter, which is trying to use non-commutative geometry as a simplified framework for exploring the idea of a non-classical space-time. I have some results that are rather striking. So let's go quickly. And indeed, since now it's the first talk I give to Perimeter on real data, really, in a certain sense. It was always saying, well, this could be the data in a few years. And so this time I will also comment on these effects by making some remarks on whether they could be generic features of a quantum gravity or different approaches to quantum gravity or not. Well, in vacuo dispersion, which is what I'm going to discuss first, is not necessarily a very generic feature, but not unnatural. The logical steps that seem more natural to get to in vacuum dispersion are introducing structure of any sort in space-time structure, features in space-time structure at the Planck scale, then by the dual relation between a space and its symmetries, this structure would also naturally show up in the characterization of its symmetries, either by in a symmetry breaking mechanism or by deforming symmetries. And the simple case that we have been playing with mostly in the last few years has been the Minkowski limit of the quantum gravity, where we might have then either broken Lorentz invariance or some form of deformation of symmetries of the type that I codified in this double special relativity concept. In either case, a typical result will be a modification of the dispersion relation. So up to this point, this is nearly generic feature. Of course, it's not completely generic. You might well have a quantum gravity that does not have any of this. But it's not, it would be rather generic if you could somehow, and it's not possible, construct a set of quantum gravity theories and samples. Now, and I will stress at some points that I'm showing you slides that I already showed at Perimeter a few years ago, so that you see the time changes. And this is a piece of a slide that I showed at Perimeter a few years ago, actually more than once, because this telescope that the data I'm reporting on are from a telescope which was called GLAST before it would be launched. And I gave all the seminars about GLAST at Perimeter. And now that it's in the air and getting data, it has a real name and it's called Fermi. That's why Fermi is lazy photon in type. And in vacuo dispersion, it's not enough to have a modified dispersion relation. You need one more feature, which might not be so, also might be somewhat generic, but not necessarily completely generic. But if you have a modified dispersion relation, to get in vacuo dispersion of the forms I will study, then you need that the velocity is given by the dispersion relation with this usual formula of the derivative of energy with respect to momentum. And as I stress here, you for that you need some sense a Hamiltonian framework to tell you that the velocity is given by the commutator of x with the Hamiltonian, with the energy, and you need a undeformed Heisenberg relation to tell you that then this x in the commutator is really derivative with respect to dt. If those conditions are preserved, these are the standard setups, but it's not guaranteed that they would be in the quantum gravity you prefer, then from a dispersion relation you get to invariant dispersion, meaning that the speed of light will depend on energy. And for many years I've been showing you this slide, on one occasion exactly this slide, another occasion similar, announcing that, well, this is a very small effect. If this lambda is of order of the inverse of the Planck scale, it's a very small effect, but gamma ray bursts have certain features that make them capable. Observations of gamma ray bursts allow to test this effect. And I started to build this case with some of you here on this data. These are BATSE data that were available in 1997 when I started to do these studies. And this is an observation of an actual gamma ray burst seen by the BATSE satellite in the middle of the 90s, I guess. And these are three channels, so observing the same gamma ray burst at three different energy scales. And basically the time over, this is time, okay, and counting photons as a function of time. And I use this slide to show you that, look, we have, it's very clear from this data that the burst arrived at the same time in all three channels. So there was no evidence of energy dependence. And because it was a signal coming from so far, if you work out the figure, in spite of the fact that the energies I spread, this is added now. BATSE Observatory was looking at gamma photons between 20 and 300 keV, very low energies. They work it out on the basis of this. We could place bounds on the scale of this deformation of a modification of the dispersion relation, okay, on the inverse of this lambda, bounds that were only a factor of 1,000 away from the Planck scale. So that was how we started to build the case that this study could, in the future, once GLAST would be taking data, could probe the Planck scale. But we build the case in the negative sense. You know, this was absence of any time delay as sharp as possible with experimental data. So it was building a case from the negative side. Now, the main thing I want to focus on today is one burst that has generated a lot of interest in all quarters, the media, the academic world, that has been observed now by GLAST, which is now called Fermi, is a gamma ray burst observed in September, a few months after Fermi started taking data. And it was a tremendous burst. Well, probably also the other ones were equally tremendous. It's just that we did not see them at the high energy part. So it was difficult to, we did not have the whole picture. This was really a monster. And maybe I should, before the comments, I should first show you. So this would be my new slide in place of the previous one, okay? The ones I used 10 years ago to show you that because of the very clear simultaneity of time of arrivals, we could put upper limits on the effects. Now, this is the data with BATSE. You see that we have gone from, well, the first channel that I'm showing is the whole of the BATSE data. All of BATSE data would have been in this first channel up to roughly 300 keV. But Fermi sees the burst even up to a few JeV, actually a few tens of JeV. So this is a completely new game. Completely, we're not even talking the same species of experiments. And now, with those energies available, it's equally obvious now that the time of arrival is not simultaneous. I don't know, you can put about a billion sigma on the statement that the time of arrival of the burst in the low energy channels is clearly the mean value is 4 on a machine that has resolution which is below the millisecond. The time of the average time of arrival of these high energy photons with respect to low energy ones differs by 4.5 seconds. So about 10,000 times or more than. So clearly, instead, now the situation is clearly undisputable non-simultaneity of the time of arrival of the photons from the burst. Unquestionable. So this is the number of photons.
So there's only 2 photons above a jet, is that right?
Well, it's 4, it's about 4.
Okay. Oh, there's more than one.
There's more, this okay. Thick, and this is about, this must be order 200. In fact, it's about 200. This is here. About 200 photons higher than 100 MeV. Okay. Thermal photons at Batze could not even see. About 200 photons higher than 100 MeV. And there is a time delay of, average time delay of 4.5 seconds between these 200 photons here and several thousand of photons caught below 100 Kelvin.
It looked as if the lower energy ones were spread out right across the whole time slot. In other words, there were ones being produced after the.
Yes, we were commenting on that.
The ones as
the
well.
Burst, the burst does not last. The burst does not last. Does not last such a short time. So
that's several seconds, is it? The burst is lasting several.
Yeah,
seconds.
This is all in scale. So this is 15 seconds. These are the 15. The trigger is very sharp. It's 500 photons that you see here.
Yeah.
They give you the trigger, so you have a very sharp time trigger. And this is all from the first 15 seconds of the history of this burst. So there were still quite a few low energy photons after 15 seconds, although the bulk of the low energy photons is all at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
There were absolutely no high energy photons in the beginning, but you had some later on.
So, in principle, this could be also attributed to the process. To
yes,
the
but process. Otherwise, it would not be.
Yeah,
it would not
be that
from
it takes a little.
From the evening news. Yes.
Of course,
there are other explanations why you wouldn't ask him to come here and do the release from the evening news.
I mean, couldn't it just be it takes a while before it's able to generate, it sort of builds up,
yes,
and then
yes,
it's able
yes,
to generate
yes,
the high energy?
Yes, this is what I have to do next. So I have to first give you these are the data. They don't look like the data that we had 10 years ago, but this is no surprise. Certainly, nobody in astrophysics, to my knowledge, had expected this size of time delays. Some difference in time of arrivals, because this is complicated burst with different phases, and you can expect some structure in the time of emission and therefore of arrival of particles. To my knowledge, before seeing this data, there was nobody in the astrophysical community writing that we should expect a 10 seconds delay. This one, the lazy, famous lazy photon, my poor lonely guy, was starting with all his friends, but then he arrives alone 16.5 seconds after the burst. And is the most energetic one. So the most energetic photon detected in this burst is 13 JeV. Okay, amazing energies in respect to Batze, with that said. And they arrive 16 seconds away. I don't think there was anything about it in the astrophysics literature before that would allow you to expect such size time delays. But afterwards, at the level of post-dictions, you can start. Since we don't understand this burst very well, so you can play with your astrophysical modeling of the burst, and certainly there is enough room in our ignorance. Let's say there is enough room in our ignorance of how these bursts work, at least, and some room in our modeling of them to accommodate even this size of time delays. So this would be, for example, this is not my slide. Since I prepared the seminar very quickly, I caught some slides on the web, and then I'll have to re-prepare them. This was a good seminar given by somebody from the clinical laboration.
And this is what they are thinking of. So some mechanism in the way the burst actually develops that would create typically high energy photons with a certain delay. So this is where we stand. My own perspective is that as a phenomenologist, it is striking to me that,
you know, the formulas we were playing with, simple minor formula I showed, well, actually not today, but several years ago at Perimeter, if you put 13 GV and Planck scale, the delay you would expect is of order of 10, 15 seconds. I mean, so it's quite striking, the numerology, that this delay is just the one that fits perfectly in that linear formula. However, and this is not, mine is not a prediction, at previous Perimeter seminar, I stressed that by seeing one burst, you cannot make any case. Because you don't know the mechanism at the source well enough, by observation of one burst, you cannot establish anything robust about how the signal has propagated to our detector. As I stressed in previous PI seminars, you need a sample of bursts at different distances from us so that you can easily then distinguish on large statistics what are things that are features of the source and what are features that instead depend on the time of propagation of this signal from the source to our detector.
Is there any way to anticipate whether it would be a delay or an advance? But, you know, that the high energy ones would come later?
In our modeling or effective theory modeling of quantum space time, you can have everything. Okay? It's nearly as dirty as the astrophysics of the problem. I guess just a little bit less. But it's, everything can come out of it. And so it could have been, in fact, the other paper that I would like to write there would be sooner, better, or later. Because if it was that the high energy ones arrived before the others, that would have been, even one burst would be enough, with the high energy one arriving before the others. But this data that I showed you give you the high energy one coming after the others. And that then has 1,000 explanations. Well, not 1,000, actually. Two plausible explanations, either the source or an effect on the propagation.
But in this case also, is it true that all of the low energy ones come before any of the high energy ones?
Yes, I don't know. I'm intrigued also by this. I mean, the astrophysicists, pretty strange. I mean,
he's just saying the answer.
Even if you have many phases of this explosion, it seems, you know, there is a large depletion of the low energy ones. So just when it starts to make the high energy one, it's no longer capable of producing low energy ones. I don't know. They can do everything. I started to believe astrophysicists can do everything on their paper. I don't know if stars and objects actually want to do that. But this is something, I don't know if you share my... I mean, they are so happy to say, oh, there is a delay in the mechanism, but it's a funny delay. It's really playing tricks on us. And it does exactly what the in-vacuum dispersion instead does. Because the in-vacuum dispersion would be that they are roughly all produced in some window, maybe take a large window, but then you have no high energy ones, no, zero in the beginning because they get the delay. And instead you shouldn't have much of the soft ones here. If you have any soft ones here, they should be emitted in a later mechanism. I mean, somehow it fits better this data, but I'm not going to dwell on that. Otherwise I would even do a disservice to my previous PI seminars when I stressed forcefully this point that we need statistics. I mean, to make a good phenomenological analysis, you need to observe several bursts, and then it will be absolutely clear if it is a feature of the source or it's something that depends on our distance from the source, which would be propagation. Please.
Yeah, what is the trigger in those experiments? Because if the trigger is in the low energy bands, how would you see an advance of the high energy photons?
You guys have come to Rome. Yes, that's another thing I would have said. Because you asked about, I am wondering if it's possible that they missed some high energy ones, but I don't know. I don't know well enough to explain. I think it is plausible that because the trigger is surely in the low energy, because it needs high statistics, it must be. So it is plausible that they're missing some cases. I don't think, I'm not saying it's likely, but it is plausible. But surely now these data are changing completely. I mean, you know, the seminars and the propaganda I've been doing with astrophysicists over the last 10 years, I can now try to get a better attention with this data and try to understand exactly what can be done. Can they trigger on a high energy? I have no idea.
This is just a minor point, but the highest one, the highest energy one comes 16.5 seconds after. But does that mean it's off the slide, or?
It's probably off the slide, yes. I think it's not counted there. For some reason. Yes. Yes, it's not. No, it would be here. It would be a one up here.
Okay.
They didn't want to reduce the resolution, I guess, of the whole picture just to catch one lazy photo.
You only have one or two photons. Great achievement, that's statistically not great.
No, but the bulk of what I'm telling you is here. It's about 200 photons. This is about 200 photons with more than 100 MeV. And all that I'm telling you really depends much more strongly on, indeed, because it is statistics, a key factor, it depends much more strongly on these 200 photons than on the few ones that are here above 100 GeV.
Compared to KeV.
Compared to KeV. In the old days, when I was first visiting Perimeter, we only had this window, and we were breaking it up in pieces. But now, just comparing this to this, forget the rest, it's quite a sharp difference in picture with respect to one we had. But clearly, it can have many explanations. I think we have good statistics, but some of the ideas can drive. I mean, looking at this data with a little bit of a positive argument can help guide future observations. For example, can we try to catch a non-lazy photon? So these are the data that most, I guess, interest here because some research has been done here is also connected with this feature. I also had roughly in those days when I started working on Invaco dispersion. Those were times, still the same, but I mean, those were times when I started to look for phenomena that could be relatively generic in a quantum gravity and understand where we were in our ability to test them. No matter if it was good or bad, the ability, but where are we in testing these features? Another effect, actually, I think I will, on the theory side, I would argue that the idea that quantum gravity effects produce excess noise in interferometry is absolutely generic. Much different from Invaco dispersion, which is a characteristic of some pictures, excess noise in interferometry is inevitable if you have any quantum gravity, which is basically not Einstein gravity, exactly a modifier. And the reasoning, of course, the reason why I've not been pushing this phenomenology as strongly as the one of Invaco dispersion and the one of cosmic ray spectral analysis, which I've discussed in previous seminars. The reason is because for this description of noise in interferometry, we don't have even the impression of a good handle like symmetry considerations to guide us in estimating what the effects could be. So, but because I have data to show you today on this, and they are also rather tempting, let me go back to my old arguments. You will see that they are very poor of substance, but they are desperate attempts to make contact between the quantum gravity intuition and experiments. And first of all, I do believe it's absolutely generic feature of the quantum gravity theory to have excess noise in interferometry. Everything contributes to noise. I was telling Lee yesterday that if I was to explain to an extraterrestrial species what is our knowledge of the laws of nature in a compact way, I will show them the spectrum of an interferometer, of our best interferometer, and they should show me there. And we will probably know in that way how much we know of the laws of physics in the most compact form possible. Everything is in there, from a truck delivering milk at 10 kilometers to the laws of quantum mechanics that also appear and contribute to the noise in a way that is visible and tangible. I mean, it is a serious obstruction for the detection of gravity waves, for example. It's a serious challenge, not obstruction, but challenge.
Are you talking about LIGO type interferometry?
For example, yes, this is my zero order reference. And of course, if you have some, any idea of quantization of space-time, fuzziness of space-time, that one way or another, either looking like the quantum mechanical type of noise sources or like seismic thermal noise sources, it should show up. I will not dwell much on that, because if I did not have the data, I wouldn't want to dwell much on that. But let me just report you what struck me as interesting in those, that's also nearly 10 years ago, is that the way in which it is most efficient, and in fact experimentalists do that, the most efficient way to characterize noise in interferometer is through this type of spectrum analysis of the noise. I use here the noise spectrum, the lowest power spectrum. You can use the square root of this. This thing has dimensions of inverse hertz. This is outside the screen, but it's inverse hertz. And if you want to have a sense of where we are with our LIGO type, for example, interferometers, we are at levels of sensitivity in correspondence to noise reduction at the level of 10 to the minus 44 inverse hertz, around 100 hertz. This is a quite a long way from Michelson and Morowitz. It's interesting. How many orders of magnitude? John, you probably know. How many orders of magnitude noise from Michelson and Morowitz? Must be 20, 30 orders of magnitude. Anyway.
But anyway, it's a big jump forward in 100 years. And now, what first struck me as interesting in those old days was that, well, if I was forced as a phenomenologist to give an estimate, a ballpark estimate of where quantum gravity could show up in affecting these noise levels, well, many phenomena give white noise, which means frequency independent. Let me try to estimate the level of quantum gravity white noise. Well, it must have dimensions of inverse hertz, meaning a time. So I said, well, the Planck time. Planck time is the natural back of the envelope attempt to set the stage. And it normally is the way to get discouraged, because when you estimate things like this, the number is very small and you give up. And that's an exercise I had done on several cases and given up of many places. On this case, I didn't give up, because actually to put this estimate of the power spectrum of the hypothesized quantum gravity noise is a very small number. But this happens to be the number where we are now. So that kept me a little bit interested. And so I for a few years, I tried to develop some phenomenological models. I had an old argument on measurability of distances, semi-heuristic arguments, as some of us like to play, on the measurability of distances in a quantum space-time. And that led me, but let me make the story short, because the data should speak more than the story. That led me to argue that there could be, well, it could be white noise on, you know, very general argument, but if I looked at the fact that quantum gravity was introducing a limitation on the measurability of distances of a certain type, in my opinion, then I ended up considering random walk noise. Random walk noise has the characteristic feature of being 1 over f squared. And this actually was the first formula I put to illustrate that the sensitivity to Planck scale effects could be there. Because if I estimated this alpha, it's not easy to estimate. And in fact, that's why then I gave up. But I could reasonably estimate this alpha in terms of the Planck length and get noise levels that were comparable to the ones achievable in LIGO Virgo type experiments. So I wrote these papers to make the point. But then I basically stopped working on it, because to make further progress, you either needed a symmetry principle to guide you or some formalization of space-time form, basically. And there are some around, but they're not manageable to the level of predicting noise levels for interferometers. So basically, I gave up. I mean, I gave up in the sense I stopped trying to get more refined models. I couldn't find any way. But now it's been now several years that one of these interferometers, the GEO-600 interferometer, keeps reporting excess noise. And now it has a name in the literature. You know, in the literature of these interferometer people, there is seismic noise, thermal noise, BS thermal noise. There are so many. And now there is mystery noise. You know? After a few years of these reports from GEO-600, there is actually is a name in the literature, mystery noise, which means noise that you don't know where it comes from. Okay?
And this now in the literature
is a well-established thing. And this is basically what is mystery noise. This green line is basically an upper bound. Well, it's an estimate. But it's an estimate that should take into account all contribution of noise that they are dealing with, and that the tradition of this interferometry teaches them how to deal with. And for many years, they have managed to match on this side, but on this side, there is a, this is a logarithmic scale. So this discrepancy is very significant. Okay. And so this became mystery noise. The blue is what they measure. I mean, the blue is the noise they see in their machine. And the green is what they expect.
We have the same shape. That's just to do with the nature of the instrument. Is that it? Or I mean,
well, roughly that same space shape in that region. It's a long story. In that region, most noise. I mean, going to low frequencies, noise grows.
Yeah.
This is a different setting up. Going to low frequency, now to calculate that is exactly the same shape is a little bit difficult. But it's roughly, they're both growing.
It looks like it's constant width, but maybe that's not.
It's not constant width.
Exactly.
It's not exact. Actually, the point, the subtle point is that it's not exactly constant shape. But now, if you add, it's nearly, I mean, what is missing apparently is random walk noise. So this is a reanalysis they have recently done, where they added extra random walk noise of the type that I showed on the previous transparency, and they start to, these are, again, I borrowed without permission, I hope that can be done. I got on the web slides from a seminar given by one of the members of the collaboration, and this is now an exercise that for the last few months they have been playing. So they are trying to model the excess noise, and it looks like random walk. So, really, this is really nothing to make out of, but it's certainly amusing that there is this mystery noise. And perhaps some of those who have ideas about space-time form can find in this motivation to do as much as a determined effort to make contact with the reality of these experiments as possible, because there might be a payoff. The reason why experimentalists are now doing this game that I showed you here is because of some recent papers by Hogan, well, most notably this one, that after seeing the data on the excess noise, he basically found a somewhat convoluted argument that Hogan described as inspired by holography in quantum gravity, but basically then he ends up fixing alpha, but after the data, after seeing the noise, he fixes alpha in this formula that I showed you from my paper. He fixes this alpha, not from the data,
but in a sense of postdiction, he fixes the alpha from a holography argument. So you should read, maybe the expert for space-time form should read if it makes any sense. But he fixes alpha after the data, but not using the data, using holography in some way, just the way that fits the data. This, of course, when you do a postdiction like this, it's difficult to impress, but this is the situation. The facts that I've reported to you are the mystery noise. The mystery noise is there. It could be, once again, it's just like in the astrophysics case, the experimentalists are trying to understand if they're making a mistake, of course. Also here, noise is difficult, like a gamma ray burst is difficult to model, noise, if there is one thing that is more difficult than modeling a gamma ray burst, is modeling noise in an interferometer, because everything goes in there and is difficult to control. But in a certain sense, I'm showing you this other slide I got from the talk by Hill. in a certain sense, what they're doing tells you that this mystery noise is really mystery. Because, for example, to match it, what they are considering is increasing their estimate of one source of noise for which they have a tradition from other interferometers. You know, it's not that they, by a factor of 3.5, not by 3.5% or 35%, but to match it, they are contemplating now that they have underestimated a known, normally known noise form by a factor of 3.5. So that looks like
sensitivity, or is there other ones which?
It's unique in its setup. In fact,
are there other ones that are sensitive which do or do not show this discrepancy?
No, no. Well, no. This is a complicated. In that region, LIGO does not see this noise. But
where does the minimum for LIGO sit? Is it below or above? I mean, it has a similar width.
Yes, yes. It's about here. Well, actually, it's around here.
So it would be right where they're seeing the noise.
Yes.
And LIGO, you don't see any.
You don't see this excess noise. And so the, but it's not the question that they're making a mistake. The experiment is very different. So you are probing, there is a question about recycling the beam. So it's not a new interferometer, GEO-600, but it uses certain techniques that the others don't use. And for example, these papers by Hogan have gone even into detail into trying to describe how stochastics, some kind of stochastic properties of space-time, let's say, of the type that I contemplated long ago, could affect more one setup than another. But this is clearly.
But even in these results, can they be able to fit with some particular value of alpha all through till very small frequencies? Or is it only in some regime that they get a good fit?
Well, it's a very large regime that they get a good fit.
But in that figure, for example, like if you go to low frequencies, his fit is again getting spoiled.
Well, I would agree with you, but I mean.
And it's also log scale, so it's very difficult to see any discrepancy, right?
Yes, I mean, the experimentalists are taking notice of this difference from year to year. I personally, I'm myself not able to tell you. Of course, the problem is that, you know, you don't really expect to match noise perfectly because it's too difficult to perform. But if you are off by a factor 3.5, it's when you start to be calling it mystery noise. They call it mystery noise. I also have this, you know, Hild on his slide. You know, they have the concept of mystery noise.
When you say it's random Mach noise, does that mean it could be, it would also be explainable if, by Brownian motion in the mirror if it was of a greater magnitude? I'm not sure what random Mach noise means.
Random Mach noise is a shape of the noise, that any process of any stochasticity in the setup could be in the path of the photons, could be in the mirrors. In fact, there is some component of random Mach noise from the mirrors somewhere.
So in particular, a Brownian motion in the mirror would produce this type of noise.
Yes, but it's already in here.
Yes, I understand.
And these are not the first mirrors. No.
I'm not looking for an explanation. I just want to understand what kind of noise we're
talking about. I mean, the beam recycling, the GEO-600 does beam recycling in a different way from I missed my anyway, so. So I'm not claiming. I mean, I think on the glass data, there is on the Fermi telescope data, there is really something that soon we will have something to analyze very firmly. I think the situation of the GEO-600 interferometer starts to be. It has been there for a few years now. It's worth reporting. I don't think there is much to be cooked with it at present. It's probably enough. It's just about enough time for 3 years that they should do what maybe Rob was suggesting. Why don't we try to make another type of interferometer, a bit like GEO-600, but a bit like LIGO. You know, go somewhere in the middle and see, try to understand what is giving this feature. Because it's not seen with LIGO or Virgo, it's seen with GEO-600. It could be that it's probing some features better than the others because it's done differently, but then let's try to do something in between, or certainly the money to build one of these machines is different, or maybe changing the setup a little bit.
Or one that's designed to maximize the response to this kind of...
Well, they are all constructed to maximize the response to gravity waves.
Right, so if you're trying to maximize the response to this noise, maybe you could do that. So I don't know.
No, it is doable. But, you know, invest money into this very speculative thing. One should come up with ideas that cost little money. And I'm the first one to say, I mean, in spite of being things that I care about more than gravity waves, but I think because of their speculative nature, you better find ways, they deserve being done, but find ways that don't cost too much money. And so maybe some changes in the setup that will clarify where this noise form at least is coming from.
It might be worth thinking, I mean, you talked about new techniques that make geos, whatever, 6,000 more sensitive. I mean, LIGO is upgrading and it's going to, it may be borrowing the same technique, so it may naturally, in your paradigm, become more sensitive.
I don't think they are upgrading in that sense, because the techniques that GEO67 uses, the key difference is that it's shorter arms, and in order to compete with LIGO, so it has to do some things different from LIGO because of the shorter arms. LIGO now is, now the long arms tell you the frequency at which you want to look for, and they all want to look around 100 hertz because that's where the gravity wave signal. So I don't think that LIGO is going in that direction. But maybe somebody could find an idea with little cost that could maybe for a few months run one of these interferometers in a different way and see what changes.
I thought in LIGO they did recycle the lights.
No, certainly they recycle part, but the level of recycling that they do at GEO600 is far beyond that because they need to compensate for a factor 5 in the length of the arms. Anyway, we are doing the discussions that I was hoping we would have 10 years ago. I was not hoping to discover quantum gravity by 2009 or 2019, but I was hoping that by this time we would have this discussion. So we would have some data and we could play with the idea that maybe this was quantum space time and certainly start probing nature about this very intriguing issue. So we have made the transition that I hoped for from simple estimates of what could be done in 10 years with the sensitivities we will have one day. Now the sensitivities are here, and we are in now the danger. Now back of the envelope doesn't help anymore. Now we need to take refined models, refined data analysis. So we are finally working the plot. And since I've learned this idiomatic expression from English very recently, and now I have to use it in every sentence. So I think that now we are at the stage when finally we are working the Planck. We are there at the scale. Well, we're not exactly where we want to be, but we are entering the regime where the Planck scale could be relevant. And so we have a different tone of discussion, and that's the ones we have today. And that's what I was hoping for 10 years ago, and that's enough of a reward. Then if we start lucky, that's much better. Now I did find, do I have 10 more minutes for you, you think? Can I go to 5 or?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Then very quickly instead, let me do, because this is, the phenomenology is what I want to do, and the mathematical physics is what I like to do. This is strange, and I need a psychologist at some point.
But anyway, so I want to tell you the story of the mathematical physics side. Simple mathematical physics, and this is also an upgrade on previous seminars. So the idea, I mean, of course they are linked. I mean, I'm not doing the mathematical physics just for the fun of it. The most of the same mathematical physics work I do is on this non-commutative space-time, because they seem to me the best chance we have, not necessarily of describing quantum gravity, but of having new ideas to make phenomenology that will guide us toward quantum gravity. It's a complicated discussion we can have afterwards. I'm not really looking for the correct answer to the problem. I'm looking for something that gives me an idea for now to probe nature in such a way that nature will tell me what is the answer. This can be an interesting discussion afterwards. But we don't need that to motivate You know, the mathematics is rather nice. And so I've been probing this idea of simple space-time non-commutativity. And there is a large literature. This has been a less solitary work. On the contrary, it's a very crowded area, the one of studies of non-commutative space-times. Crowded, but rather focused on the idea of building field theories in these spaces, okay? And most studied are as some, I mean, you have people here who do this, and they're good, and they're giving seminars, but most field theories are built rather in this canonical space-time. Theta mu nu is out of the slide, but it's two indices, of course. Or this Kappa Minkowski non-commutativity of coordinates. And for a phenomenologist that sometimes plays with mathematical physics, the key question to ask to these field theories was about their symmetry. Because if you think about even some of the things I said at the beginning of the seminar, if I have ideas on what could be the symmetries at the Planck scale, then I have immediately a very valuable tool from the point of view of devising some phenomenology. And it was rather interesting. The story of these field theories in non-commutative spaces has been rather fun. It has emerged that probably the correct way to describe the symmetries of these field theories is in terms of Hopf algebras, of, say, Poincaré-like Hopf algebras rather than Lie algebras. And this is also something that could formalize, could be a mathematical way to formalize the idea of the Phong-Poincaré symmetries in the sense of the doubly special relativity concept, in the sense of having a second relativistically non-trivial but invariant observer-independent scale. So this has been fun probing these field theories from the point of view of symmetries, and I think we have reached a rather good level a couple of years ago by finally having nether analysis of these symmetries. Because I guess without a nether analysis for a physicist to call something symmetries, mathematicians can do it much earlier, but for a physicist to call something symmetries before having a nether analysis and showing that, for example, they are strong enough to provide conservation of charge, it would be adventurous. Mathematicians can do things faster. But now we have this technique of nether analysis, we have some conserved charges. And so this is looking very interesting. In fact, I have stressed in previous seminars the Hopf algebra nether analysis type thing and the doubly special relativity implications. But I also been, my two disappointments, say 5 years ago, I don't know if I gave a seminar on that, 5 years ago, the two things that disappointed me about the state of affairs in these non-commutative geometries was the inability to do nether analysis of these candidate Hopf algebra symmetries. That has been fixed. But the other thing was, why are we just doing field theories in these geometries? Is this the only meaningful question we can ask to a non-commutative geometry, how a field theory looks in that space? After all, for example, I have many friends on, say, the loop quantum gravity side that they get amused and intrigued by questions like, how does the area observable look in this geometry? So the more geometric aspects of the space had not been probed. People had jumped to the idea of building field theories in these spaces. And so I was looking for ideas, actually for many years, never giving seminars on it, because I never got a good idea on how to describe areas. Distances I could for a long time, but they're rather trivial. But areas, I think I now have an idea worth presenting, which is in a recent paper. And I will describe it in the context where it's easier, which is the Moyal plane. The Moyal plane is really the simplest non-commutative space you can think of, because it's just a two-dimensional Euclidean geometry with this simple commutation relation. And let me take theta positive here to avoid putting absolute values on a few things. And what I can report now, finally, is candidate for the distance observable and area observable in the Moyal plane. And they have a discrete spectrum. So maybe we can exchange notes with the people, not really. But at least there is a point of contact with research on the loop quantum gravity side. Now, before I tell you how to compute, how we propose to compute distances and areas in this space, let me give you a bit, if you haven't followed closely, you might not be aware of a powerful tool that, of course, we have on in this game, which is the pregeometric description of a geometry. Sounds fancy. Indeed, pregeometry can be fancy, but here is really a trivial thing. It's just the observation that these that we see in the new theory as coordinates of a point in space, we can isomorphically map them into coordinates of a point particle in phase space. The point particle lives in an auxiliary space-time that we call pregeometry. It's not space-time. For us, space is here. Okay? But for computations, you see what I'm trying to say? Is that my community is so... If I have to study the properties of these non-commuting objects, I can map them into X and Q and P operators for a non-relativistic particle, living in a one-dimensional pregeometric space, meaning the space is not there for me. It's just auxiliary.
That seems to have to do with the Hamiltonian.
Well, actually, this is okay. To do this is okay to take a non-relativistic path.
I'm not saying it has to. I'm just saying.
I'm not saying it has to be non-relativistic. I mean, it's just like choosing a representation of an algebra. And but this is a good representation of this algebra. It's the XP Heisenberg algebra. This is the Heisenberg algebra. So we have.
So even if you had an ocean relativistic project, so we have the same Q and P.
Yes, but it's not so easy to have really robust.
I know there's problems.
There is problems. In fact, why would you do with the problem? Since the particle is not physical, the particle is a tool, computational tool for the property of the
only real question I'm asking, you're not. Time is not playing a role in this. It's just Q and P, right?
Yes, yes,
that's
definitely.
Really what I'm asking.
Actually, even in geometries where I have time, this is just a Euclidean. But even on Euclidean, you don't have time in the pre-geometry. Time is just in geometry. But this, so anyway, if you do this, it's very easy to understand that you could write to compute properties of these objects. You could choose a representation with, say, wave functions of the first coordinate, and represent them like this. It's just, I mean, trivial, but obvious, but correct. It's the only thing you can do. And now, well, it's relatively simple to figure out what to do with distances. Okay? This operator, I mean, we are now promoting this standard formula to the description of the square distance. Okay? And this will be an observable leading in the tensor product of two copies of a one of a non-relativistic particle, if you understand. So this is a property of two points. So my pregeometric description will be an observable in a space of two non-relativistic particles on the line, just to do computations. Pregeometric auxiliary description. So that's why I write them like this. These are the coordinates of the first point, and these are the coordinates of the second point, and this is the distance between the points. And now you have a well-defined problem of computing the spectrum of this distance squared operator. And it's now an operator well-defined on some Euler space that we know very well, and you get the spectrum. It's easy. Actually, this is really trivial, because in the end, unsurprisingly, this turns out in the pregeometry, it is the Hamiltonian of the harmonic oscillator. So it's really the simplest spectrum that the physicists can compute. So we have a distinct spectrum.
So in the pregeometric description, are x1 and x2 canonical to each other? Because like the formulas which you wrote in the last one.
These two commute completely, like two particles. The phase space coordinates of two particles commute. It's the two phase space coordinates of one particle that don't commute. So that's why this is a faithful description of the Moyard plane. In spite of the simplicity of the calculation, let me show you two, let me stress two things. We have equal spacing of the spectra, okay, which in the quantum gravity community has some interest to determine whether the spectrum is equal spacing or, in some cases, as in some studies in loop quantum gravity, the spectrum tends to dense up. metallic values of the area. This is so simple. I mean, the structure of the Maya plane is so simple you couldn't expect anything different. This is equal spacing spectrum. This is not so intriguing. The intriguing part is that there is a minimum distance. Okay? There is no zero distance. Two points cannot overlap. There is a minimum distance between two points. The minimum value is 2 theta.
The minimum distance at which two points can be sharply placed is 2 theta. This in itself doesn't sound striking, but if I now close quickly with the area observable, now the area observable has been more challenging, really more challenging. I've thought about it for many years. I think I have a good proposal now. Because the problem is that in this Moyal plane, actually, nobody stresses it, but we have points, but we don't have lines. The Moyal plane is a collection of points. And I'm not, and the mathematicians will probably do a better job than me to explain it in the right language, but we don't have lines. And that's been the trouble for me to understand how I could do areas without a boundary.
A very naive question.
Yeah.
Is center line a set of points?
Yes, but it cannot be. A line is a set of points infinitely close to each other. Wow.
But these points are fuzzy. In this sense, we don't have lines. I mean, these points cannot, I cannot say I have n points with n going to infinity and the distance going to zero. Because the distance cannot go to zero. Not even fuzzy. And sharply, we have a minimum distance. But at some point, I just gave up on the boundary. I said, is there some formula for area in a commutative space that I can promote to area in the non-commutative space? This is usually what we do when we quantize something. It's not so much that we look for, but we look for a classical physics formula that can be promoted to the quantum formula. And if I have a space of points, I thought, well, I need a formula that gives me the area of something on the basis of the coordinates of the points. And this is what I told Giulia and Flavio. Giulia Gubidos and Flavio Vercati were two powerful PhD students that I have in Rome. And by the following morning, we had this. Well, they had this. Because this is basically a formula, standard formula in elementary algebra that gives you the area of a triangle from the positions, from the coordinate of the vertices. Triangles are rather special, and I cannot explain why. I think by in a few years I might say that they are special in the same sense that, say, tetrahedra are in other quantum space-time pictures, but it really is. Triangles are so special in the Moyal plane, but that will be another seminar. But anyway, so this operator is a meaningful generalization of the area of a triangle. Like the area of a triangle in commutative space, its modulus gives the area, whereas the overall sign gives the orientation of the vertices. This determinant has a sign. It tells you if you put the vertices in the formula in clockwise or anticlockwise way. And of course, since it is a triangle, three vertices, three points, this observable pregeometrically must be described as an operator living in a Hilbert space of three particles, because it's 3 points.
This one needs to work, because it usually works. Describe areas. For a parallelogram, you do the wedge product of two.
Well,
still a determinant.
No, it wouldn't work. And we should discuss that. This is the reason why triangles are special. Parallelograms are not special. They're very ugly.
You have two triangles.
Just take
No. They don't commute. No, this is very fine. A rectangle is not two triangles in no sense, in particular the sense that the two triangles can never commute if they're one side in common. The two areas of the two triangles cannot be shared from the same space. I'd say, yeah, I'm close. Maybe close, and then maybe I answer to this question, for example, as a question. That would be for me more than for you, I guess. But anyway, then this operator is more complicated. It's
But you can deal with it. It's not an harmonic oscillator, but it's a spectrum you can work out. And it has a discrete spectrum. Again, not equal spacing, but the geometry is so simple, I wouldn't expect otherwise. What I wasn't sure what to expect is if I would have a minimum area. And I don't. So, and in fact, this is the point I would like to stress. Even the simplicity of the Moyal plane, we are learning something that is useful guidance for the whole quantum gravity problem, because I've seen so many papers around with this, you know, mumbling about, oh, there is a minimum distance. Oh, then there must also be a minimum area. And then there must also be a minimum volume. There is really no relation, as, you know, a little thought can say. But this Moyal plane can be used to explain to people why there is no reason, if you have minimum length, that you also have minimum area. They are so different.
Even if they have a distance between them, if there is no integration.
If you have salt, you don't need the formula. But this is explicit. I mean, this I can now. This is what I would say 5 years ago, but now I have an explicit example. Let me close, because I promised no Riemann, no pi, and no Riemann, no pi is not ready. So, but it's related to your question. I mean, not only rectangles are trouble, but what is a disk? Now, my next thing would have been, I found this way to do triangles. Can I do a disk in this fuzzy geometry, in this non-commutative geometry? Is there a sense of a disk? Now, and there had been some rather ludicrous attempts previously that failed miserably by some others. But let me stress that what we know is that you cannot. The disk basically is not there in the Moyal plane. There is no disk. Nothing. Well, no observable in no state. I cannot say. Probably there are no disks. A disk cannot be, the boundary of a disk cannot be given by points equidistant from an origin. Because no point is an origin in the Moyal plane, that's for sure. If an origin has coordinates 0, 0, because the coordinates don't commute, the Moyal plane has no origin. So there is no disk in that trivial sense of. But also, this is more subtle. The disk could be given, the boundary of a disk could be given by points equidistant from another quantum point. That would be a legitimate concept of a disk in the Moyal plane. The thing identified by a boundary of points equidistant from a given point. But it's actually very simple to show. You can see very quickly, but Julia and Flavio did it in a very rigorous way. Instead of very rigorous, I was happy much earlier. But anyway, you can show very easy, I would claim, that looking for two points equidistant from one is not possible in the Moyal plane. Let me close on this thing on the board. So this claim, let's say this is the quantum point origin, and these are two points of the boundary of a disk you would look for. But this distance and this distance don't commute. So you cannot say in any state of the geometry, you cannot say that these two points are equidistant from another point. Because whenever this one is sharp, in any state of the geometry where this one is sharp, this is not sharp, and is in no sense equal to that one. So there is no state of the geometry in which AO is equal to OB. And so the discount claim does not exist. There is actually a more sophisticated proof that I would call no Riemann no pi theorem, which, however, is not finished. I mean, it's finished at my level, but not at the level of Flavio and Julia, much higher. So you will have to wait. But this is a sense of something really special, you know, something really new in this very simple geometry. This is the simplest quantum geometry. I challenge anybody to produce a simpler quantum geometry than this one. Yet there are some valuable insights gained by this, even by this just preliminary exploration. And let me stop here. but reminding you that this part of the material physics, when I'm amusing myself, the real thing I wanted to say is that we're working the work.
Questions? So, have you tried to think about if this would have some implication about, imagine one wants to do some statistics of these points? I mean, so if you do statistical, it wouldn't be a, the partition function of the discourse of the points would have some fun statistics, right? Because you cannot.
I don't know. I mean, you probably asked me a question that I could see more easily in the periodometry, but I'm not sure. I'm not at that stage. I'm at the stage of thinking of a few points and what that means to have.
Are you asking if the points are fermions or bosons? Is that what you mean?
Yes.
Oh, that is something we have thought.
Yeah.
Okay. And this is really asking, you know, what are the representations that you take for x1 and x2? But for the results we have so far, for the observables we have, I didn't get your point. You meant that spin statistics,
yes.
I mean, in the, we are trying to find some geometric observable that could be described by the spin of the pregeometric particle. And that would be interesting. For example, all these results on the spectrum, they are exactly the same for bosons and fermions.
Yeah.
Because as long as they don't depend on spin, basically, you have all the wave functions.
I agree.
Now you're saying if I have many, which would be the polygon with many vertices, which is the other way to try to go to something like this. We have tried to go to something like this by having many, many points. But there is no way to make it this. No pi. But anyway, yes, and then the limit, the thermodynamic limit. If you have ideas, I would be fascinated. The correct answer to your question is no. I have not made any intelligent thought about this point. Yet I have contemplated this, some kind of a thermodynamic limit, because to get a smooth boundary, I mean, what Flavio, Giulia, and I have discussed a few times, several times, is from this kind of polygonal structure we have now, to try to have surfaces somehow whose boundary is a smooth line. And this is what you do in commutative ordinary geometry. It's a limit of the polygon to have a continuous curve. But in a certain sense, we have now quantum points. And maybe for that large end limit, maybe something like statistical mechanics would be, you know. But I have not thought about it in very
interesting. One of the issues about quantum gravity has always been that there's no quantum gravity experiment. If you don't have experiment for physics, it's hard to distinguish one theory from another. We even know that quantum gravity exists. So you're saying that we reached a level where we're walking the Planck scale because of this data. The problem is that you have to have some very highly non-trivial claims require extraordinary data. And when you're saying that you see quantum gravity, you have to be sure that you can really make it convincing. It's not
If I was claiming we were seeing quantum gravity, I would have a much more cheerful picture. What I'm saying is that we are now probing. We are starting, this data that I showed you today may well prove the case, that we are starting to probe what I call the Planck scale realm. Probe it. Doesn't mean that I've told you that we have discovered quantum gravity does this or that. But we now start to have data that are providing us some limited access, but some tangible access, to the Planck scale realm. Now, from that to saying that I have discovered quantum gravity or that I can discriminate between different quantum gravity theories, we are in this situation and we are at the beginning, fortunately. Okay, so we're just starting, but I think we now can claim, and I think, this seminar, I did not make such a big effort to make my case for it because I've done it in the past. But I can really robustly argue that we are starting to access the planscale realm. Now it's hard. Now it's hard. I mean, we waited so long for this. Now comes actually the difficult part because we have to understand data and theories must talk to data. And
because if you claim that you have an energy-dependent speed of light, this could just be as saying the special relativity is violated. It's not clear in the form of gravity.
Of course, once you get to, first of all, you have a discovery. Then when you have a discovery, you have to discriminate it both from astrophysics sources and also from other alternative theories. But one striking thing, actually, if we go back to the first data I showed, the one striking point is that I was meaning to make such a big claim, but just to illustrate the idea of accessing the planscale some 10 years ago, I was showing slides like this one, and I was putting the Planck scale, lambda, here was the Planck length, okay? Now, this data, and of course the explanation would be astrophysical, and fine, I'm sure it is astrophysical, but as a phenomenologist, I must report that this data, this thing of the data, fits perfectly with putting in my old formula the Planck length. Now, if it is the Planck length, and it's not going to be the Planck length, but not because it's going to be some other exotic theory, just because it's going to be the astrophysics explanation, fine. But I mean, if instead it was not the astrophysics explanation, and if it is this Imbaco dispersion, and the dispersion comes in with the Planck length here, multiplying the energy dependence. Well, okay, then we will discuss it. Right now, I don't know what I mean. Then it would be very, very striking.
Which n is that? N equals 1?
No, this is the more general case where you allow for the energy to depend, for the dependence on energy to be any power of the energy.
Right, but when you say it just gives the right magnitude,
one.
That's n equals 1.
N is n equals 1, and here the fun fact. That's the one that.
And you mean for the highest energy gamma ray photon or all high energy gamma photons fitted?
I don't know that. I mean, I have not done it, and I don't know that the experimenters so far have done really a fit. You could really fit the linear energy dependence to this data. I haven't done it. I've just taken, if I take as reference this difference or this difference then from 1 GV, that works pretty well with the linear formula with the Planck length, roughly the Planck length. Of course, there is some meaning, even on a single observation, to try and do the time-energy correlation and see in a more statistically significant sense if it fits the formula, how well it fits it.
So you're saying that if you take that formula, lambda is EM, and you can then work backwards and determine what the delay is.
Exactly.
And it comes out to be 15 seconds.
Exactly. For a 13 GV photon.
Yeah.
Yes. Which has traveled.
I can do this on the back of an image.
Yes. In fact, 10 years ago, we did this back of the envelope. But now we have to go and put this data into some chi-square.
But we can just check for this last diagram, right? That you can say, what is for the 1 GV photon? What does that formula give? And does it give between 5 and 10 seconds, the delay?
Well, not for the 12. No, this is not the way you do it. If you, just to tell you now, I don't want to. But if you do it for the second, for these ones, the way to do this then, if you do for this one, it comes out that you need 1/4 of the Planck length. It's not going to be the Planck length. And then you go here, you put that off. It's 1/4 of the Planck length, let me test if it works well here. And roughly it works. But I don't know, I have not done it. I don't know if the experimentalists have done some kind of, you know, chi-square analysis to, you know, fit the data with these linear dependence on energy.
So these alternative astrophysical models, how reasonable are they?
No, but I don't think they are so alternative. It's just that they don't know much. I mean, unfortunately, I think it's mainstream. They are not, the mainstream pictures are not detailed enough to, you know, now they can put it in, they can put it out. I'm not so, and they don't need alternative astrophysical models of the gamma ray
any
burst.
Astrophysical.
But they have to take what they already consider a reasonable model of gamma ray burst and adjust their parameters to make it work. So it's within...
What is their model for the gamma ray burst?
Well, one of the one most used called fireball models, and it is basically a modeling of how an explosion works. And there are some shocks. There is a time structure.
But what's exploding?
Ah, these are different candidates, and actually different gamma ray bursts, which phenomenologically is a very good thing. Different gamma ray bursts might be from different sources. In some cases, could be a supernovae. Some authors have argued that they're all supernovae remnants. Well, they're not the most popular interpretation.
So this is coming a long way off. So it's coming through an inhomogeneous cosmology.
Yes, it's coming from the opposite, you know, from as far as they could be, z equal 4.
So there could be fulcrum, inhomogeneous fulcrum, is causing a delay. Okay.
What?
Inhomogeneous fulcrum in the cosmology.
Oh, no. For such high energies, you're talking of ordinary electromagnetic dispersion. Oh, that is really not a player at those high energies. You see, dispersion, in fact, I guess here, dispersion is still an issue. Ordinary dispersion in medium, electromagnetic dispersion in intergalactic medium at you know, at a few hundred keV, I think it's still some contribution is given. But all forms of electromagnetic dispersion go down with the square of the energy of the particle. So they are just the opposite of the dispersion that I have tried to motivate from the quantum gravity side, which grows in energy. The electromagnetic dispersion we know very well. It goes down with energy. And, you know, already I think for these watts, it should not play any role. And in any case, it's surely less here than above. The dispersion, ordinary dispersion in medium, electromagnetic dispersion in medium, decreases with energy. So if there was any significant, was up here, but surely not down here. These ones travel undisturbed by intergalactic media.
Okay. So one thing.
For further questions, in private discussion, then we close here and thank the speaker.